Hello, welcome to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Tonight is the monthly edition of our radio program dedicated to informing Southeast Alaska K2 listeners about a myriad of psychological and social issues confronting us in our daily lives, and ultimately about living our lives with more awareness and greater happiness. There's a good chance that you know somebody who has Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia. Some of us have parents who are affected by dementia, and as we get older, we're more likely to have friends or others close to us who have been diagnosed with some form of dementia. And it's no wonder, since 1 in 8 people over 65 and half of the over 85 population are diagnosed with probable Alzheimer's disease. So, tonight, I have invited Dr. Amber Smith of the Alzheimer Resource of Alaska program in Juneau to our show. Amber has trained as a neurologist, a physician, although right now she's not in clinical practice because she is the education coordinator, is that correct, for education specialist for the Alzheimer Resource of Alaska office here in Juneau. So, welcome to Mind Over Matter.
Thank you.
And it's great to have you back. How many years ago were you on the show with me? Do you remember?
Gosh, I'm not sure. I've been in Juneau for 6 years, and
okay.
I think it was,
you know, that tells me, because you had just moved here.
Okay.
You had recently moved here.
Mm-hmm.
You were brand new. And I was absolutely delighted to know that there was somebody with your neurological training running the show here in Juneau. And I've seen so many things you've been doing in the community for educational purposes. And I've attended some of your in services for professionals, because you did the Lewy's Bodies. And
mm-hmm.
I can't remember, but I've done a couple. I've attended a couple, and it's been great. So, Amber, what led to your interest in neurology and then specifically Alzheimer's? Where'd that come from?
Where did that come from?
Well, when you were in medical
from?
School, why neurology?
Well, I just think that the brain is so complex and interesting. When you start thinking about who we are and what our brains do for us, I don't want to insult anybody, so all fields of medicine are complex and fascinating, but for me, the
mm-hmm.
brain is the most complex and fascinating for
me. I agree. Totally agree.
Okay, good.
You're right.
Good.
So, that's why.
Okay. And Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, those are studied by neurologists. Those neurologists are the specialists you might see to be diagnosed or to treat that if you do see a specialist. And so when I came to Juneau and this position was open, it seemed like a perfect fit.
Well, I tell you, it has become a perfect fit because to prepare for this program, Amber and I had lunch the other day. And boy, could I feel your deep compassion for people with dementia and almost championing, I'd say, of them. Yes,
mm-hmm.
I was very, very touched by that, and we'll talk more about that a little bit later.
Right.
But what I'd like to know, just kind of give us a background on what kind of services the Alzheimer's Resource Program provides here in Juneau. What do you do?
So we are statewide, and I'm in Juneau. I cover Southeast Alaska, so I do travel to other communities. And what can we provide? Well, anybody can call us up, and they'll be calling me up here in Juneau, with a question. And that question could be, I'm concerned about my memory. Is this normal aging, or should I be concerned?
Mm-hmm.
If you think I should be concerned, how can I talk to my doctor about this? They can even come in and get a memory screening. Other services.
Okay, somebody could get a memory screening from you.
Yes.
Super.
Now, that's not a diagnosis.
Right.
That's just starting the process, because the process
uh-huh.
of diagnosis is very involved, takes a lot of information, and really needs to be done by your doctor. But it's starting that process, discussion.
Can, say, an internist or a family medicine specialist do that thorough diagnosis?
Yes. Your regular doctor or your regular medical provider could make that diagnosis.
Oh.
And that just depends on if they're comfortable doing it And if you're comfortable with how they've listened to you and how they've gone through the process. But yes, you don't need to see a specialist to get a diagnosis, though some people do see a specialist or do need to because of their circumstances.
You know, people vary according to how they are want to avoid getting a diagnosis they don't want to hear. Some folks may be the type that feel more comfortable if they check it out right away.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a funny skin spot. And so my temperament is I want that checked out right away. And maybe somebody else's temperament would be mañana, because they don't want to hear any bad news.
Right.
So do people come to you who are overly concerned, but is that something that you see in your office where?
Yes, I see a lot of people who are very worried and can end up being quite reassured at the end of our conversation.
Okay.
And let's face it, we all forget some things,
mm-hmm.
right? I have personally shown up to a meeting. I was so on top of it. I was right on time. I had everything I needed. And I was the only person sitting in that conference room.
Yes.
Wrong day, it turned out. Not quite so on top of it. And especially, I think, if you've had a relative with dementia or you work in the field, you can say to yourself with one memory slip, is this the moment? Is this the first sign? And unfortunately, a lot of us are stressed out. We're busy. We're tired.
Mm-hmm.
And stress and fatigue and many other things can cause us to have more memory problems.
Well, the sort of gallows humor among my friends now of a similar age as my own is, well, at least now we're too old to have early onset dementia.
Right. Woo-woo! I've aged into the regular onset dementia group.
Yeah. And what age is that? What do you call early onset?
Early onset is 65 or younger.
Okay.
So regular onset is 65 and above. So
okay. Okay.
Before 65.
What about the opposite of someone who really, I would think that was more common. And actually, in my own clinical practice, what I've discovered from working with, it's usually working with the family members of a mom or a dad, an elderly person who is showing all the signs of dementia, and they're very uncomfortable. The kids are very uncomfortable about it. They come in and talk to me, not for a diagnosis, but how to get their mom or dad to get an assessment. Do you find that as very often?
I do, and that's actually another thing that people can come and talk to me about is what are some strategies for, first off, having a conversation with someone you're worried about. Because you might see a friend or family member who you're worried about, but sometimes we don't want to have that conversation. We're not sure how to have it, and we're worried about their reaction.
Yeah.
So people can come to me and we can talk about how to approach a person, how to have that conversation, and then strategies for encouraging someone to see a doctor, and how to communicate with the doctor about your concerns. I think it's very common. There's a lot of us, and I'll point to myself, who are those people who are like, maybe I don't want to go to the doctor. Oh, right.
Well, Amber, why is it? I mean, this is what makes the fear of a dementia diagnosis unique in that if I saw that somebody had a weird skin patch, we'll go back to dermatology, and they were a close friend, and I'd right away say, have you had that checked out? You know, you should have that checked out. Well, I'm kind of nosy, you know, occupational hazard or bossy.
Right.
And so I'd say, have you had that checked out? But there's such a shame around the thought that one might have dementia. And then I think what we do, since we feel that shame ourselves, that, oh, my God, I wouldn't want anybody to know. Then we project that onto the other person. We're probably right that they would feel shameful. So we wouldn't want to say to them.
I'm not sure that it's unique to dementia.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know enough about it. But people who might be struggling with substance abuse, Do friends and families always feel comfortable saying, like, I'm going to sit down with this colleague and say, hey,
right.
I see a problem.
You're right.
Right. I think there's a lot of us who, you know, we're not comfortable with confrontation. And when we look ahead to that conversation, we're worried, will the person be angry? Or what will the person say? Will the person say, like, hey, well, you're very nosy, butt out. Will they not want to be our friend? And the truth is, I don't think that that's how that usually plays out. And even if it is going to play out that way, we may have an obligation to say something as a good friend. Because if we put ourselves in the other person's position, if I didn't notice I was having a problem, and you did as my good friend, would that be a favor to me to let me know and encourage me to see my doctor?
Yeah. Well, is there any advantage to early diagnosis?
Oh, I definitely think it's an advantage to see your doctor if somebody notices you have a memory problem, because there's a lot of things that can affect memory that aren't necessarily Alzheimer's or another dementia.
Like
depression, like medications, like thyroid problems or other medical problems, diabetes, liver or kidney problems. Now, if I don't notice I'm having a problem and everyone's too scared to tell me, and I don't see a doctor, the doctor can't get that sorted out for me.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if I do notice I'm having a problem, but I hide out, well, I don't want to get any bad news, the doctor can't get that sorted out for me. So there are things that a doctor could sort out, get resolved, and deal with my memory problem.
Okay. Is there, if the true diagnosis is Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. is there any advantage?
I think that there is an advantage. I personally feel, and many Alzheimer's and dementia organizations feel, that the advantage is, number one, you know what's going on. You and your family and your friends have a diagnosis and a prognosis. And the more information you have, the more support you can get. Okay? And the more chances you have to plan for the future.
Yes.
Because while we all should have certain legal documents, a lot of us have not taken care of assigning a power of attorney or getting a living will or writing out a will for ourselves.
So in the early stages?
In the early stages, we could do that.
Yeah.
And this diagnosis might cause us to do that. Another thing is that there are some medications. And while those don't cure the disease or stop the underlying process, they help some people with their symptoms.
What are the medications?
Well, the medications fall into two groups, and one are cholinesterase inhibitors, and you may have seen some of those advertised in Epizil, Razadine, and the other group only has one medication, and it's Namenda.
What about Aricept?
Right. Aricept is the brand name for donepezil. It's a cholinesterase inhibitor.
Okay.
So you might see, if you have a friend or family, or you're taking care of someone, you might see that they're in on one medication from this cholinesterase inhibitor group, right? They might be on Aricept plus Namenda, because that works in a different way. But neither of those groups of medications are shown to stop the underlying process.
What do they do? What are their benefits each one?
The benefit is they help people with their symptoms. So helping you with your symptoms can mean you're able to live at home longer. Or even if you live at an assisted living, you're able to use the bathroom independently longer, right? And so the more independence you have, I think most of us would like that.
I read somewhere, I don't know if this is correct, that after stopping Aricept, the symptoms went back to where they would have been if the person had never taken it before. There was a sharp drop off. Is that true?
Well, we're all different. Okay, we're all different. So certainly you do hear that. For some people, if they stop the medication, their symptoms get much worse.
Quickly. Somewhat quickly.
For some people, the truth is, in very large studies of people, that's where we see benefits of medications, right? In very large studies, not everyone benefited from these medications, okay? Only about half the people in these large studies could we see a benefit of these medications.
Oh.
But there's no way in any one particular person to know if they're benefiting. Because the way the medications work,
oh,
it's not that I have symptoms.
That's right.
And I take them and you see me and I'm better. You're like, oh my gosh, the medication really worked. For most people, it's that I don't get worse as fast as I would have otherwise.
Or for half the people.
For half the people, right. So, but the only way to see that is in a large study, because there's
right.
no way that I don't have a identical twin
exactly.
that we can give the medicine to and not to me.
Right.
So,
right. So there's no comparison.
There's no
you don't
comparison.
Know what would have happened to the person, how quickly
they would have progressed.
Their disease
we're all
would
different.
Have progressed.
Right. Right. Not everybody progresses at the same rate.
How varied is it? Let's say somebody is in the early stages and they're diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the earliest that someone would die? That would take them all the way through.
Okay, so that is a very hard question, because many of the people who get dementia, right, or Alzheimer's disease, are elders. So many people who have progressive dementia, when they die, we say they die with dementia. They die of something else, not from their dementia.
Okay.
Now, some people do die from their dementia. And so if we're just talking about people who die from their dementia, that process can vary. Now, it depends on when I was diagnosed, right? But that process can vary from 2 or 3 years. The average is 8 years, but people can live 12 years or even 20 years.
Okay.
So we're all different.
And that group you're talking about, is the diagnosis was they died of the dementia.
Right, when we're talking about that average, because if you say what's the earliest I could die, I could walk out of the doctor's office after getting my diagnosis and be hit by a car
right.
or
so
have a heart
attack. Somebody who had really early onset, say, at 50,
right.
and
they're
a healthy
very
body,
healthy.
They could live a long time. They could live a long time. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's why our support of caregivers is so important.
I've worked clinically with a handful of individuals who know that they are diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Okay.
And they come in to see me.
Great.
They're in early stage Alzheimer's. They come in to see me because they're coping with their emotions
mm-hmm.
about having the diagnosis.
Okay.
And then as I continue to see them, they're coping with their loss.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, day by day, step by step, even to the point of going into supportive living.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working with them. So these people were quite aware.
Right.
They're the one. So then I also work with a population where the adult son or daughter comes in and they say, Dad denies having any problem. I would think, just from my experience, that unless you were really fooling yourself, you know darn well you're moving into dementia.
Well, that's actually not the case. And that goes back to people not seeing the doctor as well. Because I really avoid the word denial when we're talking about the person with dementia.
Okay.
They may have denial. But to me, the words denial implies that my brain works in such a way I could see that I have a problem. But I choose not to. Okay.
Mm.
And I think the problem with using the word denial when we're talking about people with a progressive dementia is they have damage to their brain. And because we're all different, sometimes that damage is happening in a way that I'm very aware that I'm having problems. And it's scary. And I can then choose not to see the doctor because I don't want to get bad news, or I can choose to see a therapist like yourself. But in other people, the way the brain is being damaged, they really cannot see they have a problem. And so I just call that a lack of insight, because the word denial, I think it's so associated in our culture with substance abuse problems.
And badness.
And we deal with it in a certain way with substance abuse. Like we're all going to get together in a room and say, you know, Dad, you've got Alzheimer's. You know, Dad, you've got Alzheimer's. And break through. And the person will say, like, well, thanks. I do have Alzheimer's, right? That's not going to happen because of the brain damage. And so I think we as caregivers can be in denial about the problem that the other person is having. But I think the person themselves, the change in their brain prevents them from seeing it, and they may never see it.
Well, in a few minutes, I think we might talk about family members, but now is a perfect time to take a break. So we're going to take a short music break and be right back. If you're just joining us, I'm Elaine Schroeder, and this is Mind Over Matter. In the studio with me tonight is Dr. Amber Smith of the Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska program here in Juneau. And we're talking about the impacts of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. So stay with us and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. Tonight's show is about Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, and I am talking with a local specialist, Dr. Amber Smith, of the Alzheimer Resource Alaska program here in Juneau. So welcome, I was wondering if this would be a good time to inject something that is sort of a non sequitur in all this, and that is head injuries in sports. There's been news coverage about a new report that came out about football. So many of us have kids that play football or play soccer. Even today, my older adult children, two sons, play soccer, and I worry about their brains. So what's up with that, Amber?
Well, I think it's just something to think about and be aware of. I think the study you're referring to, I saw it in the news too, has to do with it looking like there's an increased risk of dementia for kids who play tackle football when they're 12 and under.
Yes.
Is that the one you're referring to?
Which doesn't mean that there isn't an increased risk for people who start when they're 15.
Right, and there's more of that in the news too, looking at our professional football players and looking at cognitive changes. I think it's something to be aware of, right? As much as you can, I think you should directly protect your brain. And that can involve wearing helmets when it's appropriate, like riding your bike or even skiing, as we were just talking about on the break.
Ice skating.
Wearing a seatbelt in the car, right? Making sure that your kids are in appropriate car seats or booster seats. I think those are all great things to do to directly protect your brain.
Well, since your Alzheimer's Association, there is also a closed head injury group in Juneau, is there not?
There is a traumatic brain injury.
A TBI, a traumatic brain injury support group,
and okay, that's run through Southeast Alaska Independent Living.
Okay.
So you could contact SAIL about participating in the support group.
You know, I asked you what kind of services your program provides, and then we went off on a riff on a couple of other items, which is wonderful. But let me finish, because I know you do more than individual consultation. So you also have programs and in-services. What's going on now?
Well, we do a variety of trainings. Once a month, I do a two-hour training on a different topic every month. So coming up in this next month, the end of February, it's going to be Alzheimer's 101, basically. What is Alzheimer's? What is that diagnosis process? That sort of thing. But that topic can vary. I do trainings for family caregivers, so families and friends, and then also trainings for professional providers. And that can be folks who work at assisted living homes or do in-home care or work at nursing homes or hospitals.
And are these trainings free or do you charge?
Well, most of my trainings are free. There are some that have a charge. Everything is free. Calling me up, consulting with me, borrowing something from my lending library, trainings for friends and family and the general public. That's all free. There are some trainings I do for professionals that have a small fee associated with them. But really, I will speak to anybody who invites me. So I also speak to community groups. I've spoken to like the retired employees of Alaska group, those sort of groups, just about, you know, what is Alzheimer's and what are their concerns.
Well, the Savvy Caregiver class you give, is that what it's called?
Yes.
And there's one coming up in several weeks that is for non-professional caregivers, family members who are taking care of people with Alzheimer's. So what does it mean to be a savvy caregiver?
What does it mean to be a savvy caregiver?
Well, there's a book called The 36-Hour Day.
Yes.
And that's kind of a classic in the field.
It is.
And it seemed to me that a film clip you recommended is focusing on being present where the person with dementia is at. So rather than if they say, about their deceased husband, when will Fred be coming home? You don't say, honey, Mom, Dad died 5 years ago.
Right.
So could you talk a little bit about that angle? I think that's the biggest hurdle for people who are close to individuals.
Right. I think that is a huge hurdle, is meeting the person where they're at.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that's a huge hurdle for a couple of different reasons. One big reason is it's not our natural way of talking. Right. Our natural way of interacting is if you say something that's not true, I correct you. Right.
Right.
I try to bring you with me to what's the facts, what's my reality.
And you're going to train me. You're going to help me out by telling me that Dad has died.
Right.
So I don't continue to make that same mistake.
Right. And we used to actually do that in dementia care. It was called reality orientation. We tried to bring you back to reality. Okay, so, you know, instead of just meeting you where you were at, I tried to bring you back to where I was. We don't do that anymore. It didn't seem to be helpful, and in fact, it can be very hurtful.
Oh.
In the example you gave, right, if somebody is looking for a deceased loved one, and they believe the person is alive, and you are breaking the news to them that the person is dead.
Mm-hmm.
That can feel to them exactly like it feels to you and I when we first hear the news that somebody we love has died.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who have had that experience, that is an extremely painful experience, and you don't want to have it again.
And they would literally have that grieving.
That very same
that
experience.
Shock.
The same experience. They don't know the person's dead, and you're breaking the news.
Yeah.
And guess what? They might have that same experience multiple times a day because of the short-term memory loss. So you break that news to them. They are horrified. They are overwhelmed. They are shocked. And several hours later, they're looking for that loved one, and you break the news to them again.
Oh.
Oh, please don't do that to me.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Right, and that's part of my championing of great dementia care because, you know, we're all at risk. And so someday when I have dementia, I want to get great care. But so now we try to meet the person where they're at.
So what would you do with the woman who thinks Fred is still around, her husband, but he's not?
Right, well.
So she says, when's Fred coming? What would you do?
Right. Well, we want to know that person. So we need to know a little bit about who is Fred, right? If I'm caring for someone, this is an advantage that friends and family have, right? That professionals need to seek out this information. So hopefully I know who is Fred and I know something about Fred. And so I would try to talk about Fred without piling on and telling a big lie. Okay, so I'm trying to meet the person where they're at without saying, well, Fred went fishing in Petersburg, and so he's going to be back on Thursday, right? There's no need for that. But maybe I could talk about Fred and his fishing. Maybe the person has a picture of Fred in their room that we could go and look at.
So kind of diversion
well,
with, okay.
It's meeting them.
Yeah.
Where they're at. If they think it's 1972, there's no need for me to pull them to 2015. Fine, it's 1972. You know, let's be there.
I think it meets the needs both of the family. We're talking about a family caregiver as well as the person diagnosed with dementia.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I think we should mention here that if you could explain how dementia is an umbrella term, and there's several forms of dementia, could you just explain that briefly?
Sure. So that we're all using the same terminology.
Yeah, right.
If somebody has dementia, if the doctor or you or I are using that term, that just means they have a change in their thinking, so a
mm-hmm.
problem with their thinking they didn't have before, in at least two areas of their thinking, like their memory plus their reasoning, severe enough to impact their daily life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's many different diseases that cause those same symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So Alzheimer's is the most common cause of dementia. Alzheimer's is a specific disease.
Do you have a percentage, like, you know, 75%?
Yeah, 60 to 80%.
Okay.
But many other diseases can cause those same symptoms. So there's a disease called Lewy body dementia, which causes a dementia. Vascular disease can cause dementia. So everybody with Alzheimer's has dementia.
So stroke, vascular disease, stroke?
Right. So one big stroke could cause dementia, or a series of tiny little strokes that you don't even notice at the time, mm-hmm. but the symptoms build up, right? They're just vascular changes in super small blood vessels that, as they're affected, are affecting small areas of brain cells.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, as more and more affected, the person gets the symptoms of dementia.
What about Parkinson's?
Yes. There's some debate about the percentage of people with Parkinson's who get dementia. But some people think it's about a third of the people who have Parkinson's disease go on to also get a dementia.
Okay. And is that, I've heard Lewy's bodies sort of compared to Parkinson's dementia. Is there some similarity or not?
Well, the reason those are associated with each other and we talk about them together is because in Parkinson's disease, the change that's happening in a part of your brain that controls movement, if we look at the brain of somebody after they die and we look at it through a microscope with certain stains, the change in the cells in that area, we call those things we're seeing Lewy bodies.
Okay.
If we look at somebody's brain and the change is in this thinking area of their brain, and they had a lot of dementia before they died, and we look at those cells and we see Lewy bodies, we say they had Lewy body dementia. So the pathological change we're seeing is the same, but it's in a different area of the brain.
Okay. Okay. What's the research on the incidence of Alzheimer's, say, today compared to 100 years ago when people just said senility?
I don't think that we have a research on the incidence of it, and I think that most of us would say that the incidence of it is the same. But why there are more and more cases of it are because of a couple reasons. And the biggest reason is more and more of us are in the age group that is at risk. Mm-hmm. So 100 years ago, certainly there were people who lived to be 85 and older. But it wasn't such a big group of people. Mm-hmm. Now, many more of us are living into that age category because of other medical advances.
Right, right.
And because our population in that age group is growing with the baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Baby boomers are just coming up into that 65 and older group. And so we have this population bulge. I think we're also seeing more people because we identify it. Because we don't do what we might have used to do, which is like, oh, that's how old people get. Right?
I've lived in rural Asia, Nepal and India,
okay.
for 6 years, and there were no facilities at the time, except in big cities perhaps, for people with cognitive impairments, particularly with dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And so people just lived at home.
Okay.
And village life was pretty simple.
Okay.
And village life was small. It was a small community. It'd be like Gustavus, except everybody was living a lot closer together. And I was just wondering, cross-culturally, if the impact of dementia in a hyper-technological society, in terms of how difficult it would be to function. I mean, if you can't use a computer, you're in trouble more and more. In fact, I worry about that because I'm not very computer savvy. And so I'm worried I won't be able to travel because the only way to check in is with your smartphone,
mm-hmm.
right? I don't like smartphones. But anyways, that aside, in village India where I was, there were definitely people who would be called senile. And I'm just thinking of turn-of-the-century America, that the other change of identification would be at what point does somebody have to go to a home? At what point if you never take buses, if you never drive, which is typical if you're a villager in India, or you rarely, you certainly don't drive because you can't afford a car or a motorcycle, so you never have driving impairment, you don't work at a job in an office, you tend the field, and the elderly are given a break from that. They don't have to do it. I would think that it would be much easier to slide along with some cognitive impairments than it would be in the U.S. So it'd be just a very different, or in all other developed countries.
Well, I don't know the exact answer to that, but I imagine in every culture, right, people have roles that they fulfill and that there's complexity to their job. So even if I work in the field, there's probably a lot of knowledge that goes into that about how I plant things, when I plant things. If I work in the home, you know, there's probably a lot of knowledge that goes into preparing food and different things that might be affected by dementia. I think, you know, a change perhaps from the cultures you're describing to some things that happen for us are how much we know each other and how much we know our neighbors. Because in a small town, even here, you know, people call me, and a great thing can be about a small town is if you let your neighbors know and your friends know that your loved one has dementia, and that if they see them alone downtown, to give you a call and to tag along with the person,
right?
That's great. In a big city, if you see someone, you don't know who they are. You don't know that they're lost and they should have a caregiver with them, right? Mm-hmm. You just go about your business. Even if you stop to help them, who are they,
right?
And that's why we recommend people have ID bracelets that say, I have a memory problem and this is who you should call, or some other form of ID. So I think that can be... that more community atmosphere could be a great thing.
Okay. Okay. Hey, let's hear a little more jazz, and I would suggest we take a very short music break and be right back. And if you're just joining us, I'm Elaine Schroeder, and this evening I'm talking with Dr. Amber Smith, a trained in neurology, though not working clinically at the moment, and she's the education coordinator for the Alzheimer Resource of Alaska program here in Juneau, and we're talking about the impacts of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. So let's roll the music, and we'll be right back.
Maybe you dreamt it too.
Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Elaine Schroeder, and tonight's show is about Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Tonight, I'm having a discussion with a local specialist, Dr. Amber Smith of the Alzheimer Resource Alaska program, and her office is here in Juneau. Amber, where is your office, actually?
My office is on Hospital Drive, 3225 Hospital Drive. It's the same building that SAIL and the United Way is in, right on the corner there.
Okay. And you're open 40 hours a week? Or
yeah, I'm open
roughly
9 to 5, but since it is a one-person office, if I'm off doing a training or talk someplace else, then there is nobody at the office. So you can always stop by to see me, but it's great if you want to make sure I'm there, you might want to call in advance.
Okay. You pointed out an article that I found very interesting in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Myself and a number of my friends have added a dementia provision to our will.
Mm-hmm.
Not to our will, but to our medical directives. And it may say if at a certain time, if these symptoms are present, dementia symptoms are present, stop feeding me by hand or by tube and stop giving me liquids. And the
yes.
article was all about that.
Yes.
So could you give me some of your thoughts about the article and about that issue, actually?
Well, I can give you some thoughts about that issue. I think that we do have the, you know, right to put in our medical directives and have it followed. Whether we would like to have a feeding tube or not, okay, because that is considered a, you know, intervention. And so I recommend that when you do a living will, which is just a way of expressing your ideas about what medical care you would like to have or not have, if you can't speak for yourself, that you do put in, would I ever want to have a feeding tube where they're putting food and liquid
mm-hmm.
in. However, this article in the New York Times and what you and I had talked about is a little bit different. To say that, you know, if I was at a certain stage of dementia and couldn't feed myself, I would like my caregivers to withhold all food from me, not given by a feeding tube, but not offer me food by mouth. Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think that legally that is going to fly. And I think there's a good reason that legally that is not going to fly. Because what if, Elaine, mm-hmm. so you've written this down.
Mm-hmm.
Now what if in 10 years that comes to pass? You do have dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And you're at whatever stage you've written. You know, now it's important to know there's a lot of different staging systems. But there I am in the room. And I have an ice cream sundae, and while you can't use your language to say, please, Amber, give me some ice cream sundae, you're clearly pointing at the sundae with a look on your face like, give me some sundae. And when I put the ice cream sundae in front of you, you put your head down and take a big bite. And then you smile at me and look delighted. Now, into the room comes somebody who says, no. Past Elaine, 10 years ago, wrote down that she should not be fed. Okay? Well, I don't think I'm going to take that sundae away from you. I think that maybe you've changed your mind, right? We all have the right to change our mind. And
people with dementia have a right to change their mind.
Yes,
and
they do. And
they have the
right to make choices. All throughout dementia, you have a right to make choices. Now, what choices you have a right to make may change. We don't let people with certain changes in their brain sign legal contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do that if they can't understand the consequences, right? It's not fair to have you signing a legal contract to buy a house if you can't understand the full ramifications of that.
Uh-huh.
But we still let you make other choices about what you want to eat or wear or participate in. Right. So I don't think legally your lawyer is going to be able to come into the room and take that sundae away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that would be right. I think that we're not very good at predicting what will make our future self happy.
That is the concept I want to explore.
Mm-hmm.
The future self.
Yes.
And with the disabled rights movement, is that what it would be called? The future self, okay, the future self is the self that we can't understand. And you used an example the other day. Do I feel the same way now about a lot of things that I did when I was 19?
Right.
Or 20?
Right.
And I don't.
Right.
And I hope not.
I hope you continue to change and grow.
In fact, have you ever had the experience where you go back and look at letters that you wrote 30, 40 years ago, and you went, I wrote that?
Who was this foolish person?
Yeah, who was this? Or eloquent person.
Right,
yeah,
right.
I can't write like that anymore. So that's a very interesting concept of your future self with dementia may want to live.
Yes.
And this is a sticky wicket because let's say instead of feeding with a spoon, you have no tube feeding. So let's say the person with dementia needs tube feeding. Well, your medical directives said no tube feeding if I have a terminal illness. And let's say you have a concurrent terminal illness. You have cancer and dementia. So you are not of a mind to be able to sign a legal document or change your mind, but you could. They will still honor that. Let's face it; they're going to honor if you have your person who has power of attorney there, and they look at your document. They will honor that, even though cognitively you are not able to change your mind. See, if you didn't have dementia,
right,
and you had terminal cancer and your mind was sharp, you could say, "Listen. Give me that form back. I decided I do want tube feeding."
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
Your power of attorney is meant to make the decisions they think that you would make if you could speak.
Exactly.
And that's why I think it's very important to write it down.
Yeah.
But the most important thing is to share that with people and to have a discussion with whoever you've chosen as your power attorney and other family members so they really can try to put themselves in your position and say, what was she really trying to say here? Because what you write down can't really apply to every situation that could happen. Who knows where I'll be in 20 years?
It's an imperfect tool.
It's an imperfect tool. And so what is the tool is having the conversation about what matters to you, what you're really aiming for here. I think that's the important part.
The other thing that struck me when we were talking was the quality of life issue. So
yes.
I think that so many of us are spooked by and so fearful of having dementia. And I know when I was visiting my father-in-law, who was laying pretty unconscious with Lewy's body dementia at the age of 92, I really projected and thought, God, I don't want to have that happen to me. I don't want to be in his position. And it's I think the scariest thing. It's scarier than fearing you have cancer or anything else. And
dementia's so very scary.
It is hard to imagine, I think, that a person in that situation, or let's say in a more mid-stage dementia, they can't take care of themselves, they don't recognize people, they're still talking, they're still sitting in a chair, have a quality of life. And you were opening my mind up about that.
Mm-hmm.
So could you just say something around that?
Sure. I guess what we talked about was what is quality of life or what is well-being? Right? Does, for me to have a sense of well-being, do I need to be in a state of perfect health? And we don't believe that in the dementia care movement, and I don't think you believe that, because most of us are not in a state of perfect health.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well-being means something else. Well-being has to do with our mood over time, right? It can't just be our mood, because my mood goes up and down over the day. But what is the preponderance of my mood over time? Also, it has an evaluative component to it, where I say, what's my own view of my life? And I don't think being in a state of well-being depends on my IQ or my intellectual capacity in that way. It doesn't matter that I know a bunch of facts. When I think about times where I've had a sense of well-being recently, right, and I have many times like that, but when I think about visiting my family over Christmas, so there I am, I'm sitting in the living room of my childhood home, the Christmas lights are on, the fire's going, and I'm surrounded by friends and family. Okay, I have a sense of well-being. Now, my IQ doesn't figure into that at all. No one is quizzing me. I don't need to know who the president is or what your middle name is.
Or whether you had lunch.
Or whether I had lunch. I'm warm, I'm safe, I'm comfortable, and I'm loved. So I think that thinking about quality of life, I think too often we're thinking like, gosh, if I can't do this one specific thing, I don't want to live. And that's that article we looked at in the New York Times, right?
Right.
I can't hike to the top of Mount Roberts. Well, well, gosh, you know, we change over time.
Yeah.
We adapt.
Yeah.
And often we project ourselves on others that we think they're not happy. But if we ask them, they are happy and they can experience well-being.
We have a lot more to talk about. And I would like to invite you back for a show. I know you're teaching in March, but perhaps another month you can come back.
I'd love to.
So our time is running out, and I want to thank you so much, Dr. Amber Smith, for coming in tonight on our show and sharing your expertise. And thank you to our listening audience. I'll be hosting another program with another guest coming up in the Monday evening, March 2nd at 7 p.m. And I would like to thank John Kramers, who's been wonderfully picking out music and working the board. So thank you all. Good night.